In 1888, Dunedin Hospital had just 5 female nurses. They worked every day for 12 hours, with a half day on Saturday, which they made up for with extra hours on Sunday. And the pay? £12 a year, with the promise of extra training. The history of this tough profession, from the transition it underwent when, quote, modern nursing was brought to New Zealand via English expat nurses, has been captured in a book called New Zealand Nurses, Caring for Our People, 1880 to 1950, by Pamela Wood. It looks at how New Zealand developed its own distinct Kiwi nursing culture and is stacked with the words of the nurses themselves, sometimes sad, oftentimes matter-of-fact, and many times downright funny. Pamela is with us now. Kia ora and welcome.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you.
I suspect this is a book that you had been wanting to write for some time. What is so luscious, I guess, about the prospect of delving deep into the history of nursing here?
Well, I'd been working in this field doing the research in nursing history for about 30 years, and then I retired, so I had the chance to really concentrate even more on it and bring together everything I'd learned and add some new research and write a book that would be available for general readers, because everything I'd written before then had mostly been in academic and professional journals.
It's also richly, as we said, it's the voices of the nurses themselves that's so compelling. And I'm really curious as to where these archives were, where you went for your information to bring such life to the pages.
Well, I was really lucky because nurses have been writing stories and telling stories for all of these years. So it was a matter of actually reading as many as I could find, but then selecting the few that I could put in the book. So there are far more stories than appear in the book itself. So they're held in archives around the country, hospital archives, Department of Health archives. They're held in museums and libraries. And it's really a matter of trying to get a reasonable coverage across the country and then make a selection that would really tell the story.
You write how New Zealand's early nursing days were influenced by the English nursing diaspora. What ideas did they bring with them, and how did that change the landscape here?
Right, they brought with them a very professional attitude to nursing, and it made a radical change in New Zealand hospitals, because until then, if you were in hospital, you would be looked after by an untrained wardsman, and some of them were really good, but a lot of them were pretty rough and ready and often drunk, and you might be looked after by, again, an untrained female domestic staff member. So what these British nurses, mostly British, brought with them was the idea of professional nursing and thorough training, and they set up the training hospitals in the main hospitals around the country and gradually out into the smaller ones as nurses became trained and could move into those positions. And they brought with them a very considered way of providing excellent care and the idea of what a nurse should be and do. And any nurse trained in that system, whether it was in England or Canada or Australia, would be able to walk into a ward here and understand what was going on and could join in and work. But what New Zealand managed to do was to create its own professional culture beyond the hospital and bring in a number of firsts in the world, really. So that was the distinct difference between New Zealand nursing and nursing elsewhere.
We'll work through those, but first at the start, I'm just sort of sitting in horror at the thought of being in hospital in 1888 or whatever and having a drunk wardsman attending to me. We think of the excellence we experience now and the care we experience now. But there's a famous name right at the start of this professionalising, of course, which is Florence Nightingale herself. And did she begin this trend of nursing schools that then went out?
She's known for that, yes. There were religious orders who were spreading what we would think of as modern nursing as well into some countries, but mainly the credit is given to Florence Nightingale because she set up the first school of nursing in Britain at St Thomas's Hospital in London in 1860. And she was able to do that because she was given a large sum of money by the British public in gratitude for what she had done for British soldiers in the Crimean War. And she didn't want to keep the money herself, so she set up this training hospital. And as nurses became trained from that and spread around other hospitals in Britain, that was the beginning of the diaspora. And so she is known as the founder of modern nursing.
There's so many lessons for our current issues out of this history. Let's just clarify at the outset that at the specific time you're writing about, 1880 to 1950, the profession was largely dominated by women. I think there were a few male nurses maybe after the Second World War.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
And they had their own separate register. Yeah, they had to be accommodated yes. separately, of course.
Yes, they did. They had their own separate training course, 2 years for most of them. They only some hospitals could afford to do training programs separately for men because, as you say, they had to be accommodated separately and they couldn't work with female patients at that time. So for the time period I'm looking at, yes, it was overwhelmingly female. And that's what New Zealand doctors were calling for once they had recognised that female nurses trained in the Nightingale system had they really contributed well and meant better outcomes for patients. And then, of course, better reputations for the physicians and surgeons.
You see, this brings us straight to the question of pay equity today, doesn't it?
Yes.
And this argument that, and you make it in the book. I mean, there are references in the book to the exploitation of the, quote, generous impulses of young women. This was an editor, a newspaper editor in 1907 writing about
yes.
this.
Yes, that's right. And the argument that was given most often for low pay for nurses was that they were receiving training in return for their service. And so it was just a small amount of money that was given to them. And if you look, say, in the 1920s, when there was a survey of female, predominantly female occupations, nurses were the lowest paid. And they were receiving at that time an average of £52 a year. And a woman working in an office would receive on average £70, and a cleaner and a waitress were earning £100. And so there was this discrepancy. And the idea of the receiving training in return doesn't really hold because trainee teachers were earning £100 and were working fewer hours. So this was, at the time, nurses were still working 12-hour days. Trainee nurses were working 8 hours officially, but usually longer, because the nurse on afternoon duty was often called in to work in the operating theatre in the mornings as well. And they were working 7 days a week. So it was, you know, you couldn't compare trainee teachers with trainee nurses.
It's just baked in, isn't it? Here in the book, Dunedin Hospital, what year was this? Sorry, it's on page 48. Dunedin Hospital had five female nurses who worked 7 days a week for 12 hours a day, got £12 a year, I've got. I'm not sure
yes.
what date this was.
Yes.
Domestic servants earn more money.
Mm. Yes, definitely. And isn't it good that the newspaper editor picked it up and was talking about it? So there was this awareness that nurses weren't being paid properly. I mean, New Zealand nurses have a 140-year record of being underpaid, and it's only recently that they've been able to make significant strides in that direction, but still working towards a fair recognition of their professional worth.
This, of course, is before equal pay legislation. We're not even talking about comparing between female-dominated and male-dominated professions. We're actually comparing within working women's pay
yes.
rates of the time. It's just baked in, Pamela.
Yes.
Okay.
It's just there. Mm.
Tell us what the profession was like late 19th century, turn of the century, and what the practice of medicine was like at that time. What would they have experienced? What would they have been doing then?
At the turn of the century, they would have been, well, let's take a typical day. So they would come on duty and we're talking hospitals at the moment, they would come on duty in the ward and they would be immediately tending to the patients, getting them washed, sponged if they're on bed rest, which was mostly, and getting them freshened up and ready for breakfast, bringing out the trays, the heavy trays of food, delivering it round to the patients, helping those who needed to be fed. And then the more senior nurses would be attending to the dressings if it was a surgical ward or special treatments. And of course, everything also was geared in the mornings to the doctor's round, and so everyone had to be spick and span and tidy in their beds, straightened up, ready for the doctor's round, and then just generally tending to patients' needs as they went through the day. It was hard, heavy work because people were mostly on bed rest, which meant you had to do everything for them, especially if it was called complete bed rest, where they couldn't even lift a hairbrush or a book to read, and everything had to be done for them. So it was very physical work. And the junior nurses would be doing the cleaning of the ward, strewing damp tea leaves on the floor before they swept the dust, and, you know, cleaning lockers and bed rails and so on. So there was a great deal of cleaning for the junior nurses, and the more senior nurses were taking on those more significant roles of medications and dressings and so on.
You're right about the the qualities that were expected of nurses in the 1930s. Nurses were given marks for their reliability, cheerfulness, interest, economy, etc. What might get you rejected?
Oh, well, what might get you put on the mat, so to speak, was not giving due respect to the ward sister, of course. But really what they were looking for was your attention to the patients. So kindness, gentleness, patience and so on were really important. And the best thing that could be said about a nurse was that she was kind to her patients. And you see this in letters written about nurses, or even in obituaries, you see that as the hallmark of a really good nurse. So it was really all brought about for that reason, for the benefit of the patient, but also for the benefit of the hospital. So you needed to be punctual, obedient, loyal, and qualities like that, which meant that you would be doing your best for the reputation of the hospital as well.
One was rejected for being too short of stature, although I think she might have been eventually accepted. One was rejected in 1913 for having been a barmaid. The ward sisters, it's funny, we think of it as a stereotype, but there is a real history here. They had a certain kind of stern gravitas, and was that just expected of them? It was a job requirement.
Yes, and if you look at a register that the matron of Napier Hospital kept, she makes comments about the ward sisters, and there's one entry there that said she was considered to be rather tough on the nurses, but was a very good manager. So that was the quality that was being looked for from the ward sisters, running an efficient ward and teaching the nurses how to do the same.
You mentioned the innovations, the firsts. Could we work through as, the 20th century unfolded, can we work through where some of those innovations came from, where we sort of took an imported model but then started doing things their own way?
Yes, and largely that came down to Grace Neill, who was the first chief nurse in New Zealand. And by that I mean someone in a government department with responsibility nationally for all nursing matters. And Grace Neill was the first in New Zealand from 1895, and she's been regarded by international historians as the first chief nurse in the world. And she was envied by nurse leaders in America and Britain because she had this position and could bring about change. And of course, at that time, New Zealand was small in population. It could do things very nimbly, could bring about change quite quickly. and it was considered the social laboratory of the world. So it wasn't surprising that Grace Neal could bring these changes about. So the Cape Colony in South Africa had state registration of nursing from 1891, but New Zealand was the first country to have a Nurses Registration Act, special legislation for that, and it gave nursing a very solid grounding, a platform for recognition as a profession. And Grace Neal instituted the training that would be done. She wrote the syllabus. She organized the state exams for nurses to present themselves and for qualification and registration. And that was not done in Britain until they got the legislation passed finally in 1919, and the register opened about 1923, even though they'd been trying a long time to get state registration. So New Zealand could act quite swiftly in these things. We were the first to have nurse inspectors of hospitals, and more nurse inspectors were added as the government department grew. We were the first country, as far as I can tell, to have a government scholarship scheme to support Indigenous women to train as nurses. And, of course, the first Indigenous registered nurse. So there were a lot of things that were happening that only happened here and sometimes were taken up later by other countries. But certainly New Zealand nurses were recognised as being innovative in these ways for the profession of nursing.
I think that first registered Māori nurse in the health system, 1896, did her training. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, it depends. There's been some discussion about who the first Māori registered nurse was, and at first it was recognised as Akinei Hei. She registered in 1908, but she's actually the first to be qualified as both a nurse and a midwife. That's her standing, and she's been very influential. Her memory has been very influential in developing nursing. But before that, another historian, Diana Musters, recognised that Mariana Tangata, who trained about that time that you're mentioning in Auckland, she trained under a Pākehā name of Mary Ann Leonard, and so that is her name in the register. And it wasn't for a long time that we recognised she was Māori. But also, I was looking for further records, and Kate Wiley, who trained at Gisborne Hospital in the later 1890s, she is, as far as I can tell, she's the first Māori registered nurse. She's 26th on the register.
Goodness. Pamela Wood is our guest. New Zealand Nurses Caring for Our People, 1880 to 1950 is her book. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. There's also the district nursing as well. And again, did it come out of the Nightingale School of Nursing, but did it take on its own particular, flavour here?
Yes, it did. Florence Nightingale was very interested in district nursing and was supportive of its development. And so we have that foundation from Britain. And here we had a person called Thomas Herrick, who, as far as I've been able to discover, was the originator of district nursing here in New Zealand. He set it up for the City Mission. He employed a registered nurse to go about caring for the people in their homes who were in need. And then Sybilla Maud, of course, developed district nursing more fully, also in Christchurch, but 18 months after the first registered nurse, district nurse, had been appointed with Thomas Herrick. But it was Sybilla Maud who really led the way in the development of a whole service. And people came to her to see how she was organising it and would be able to take those ideas back to their own towns and set up services there. The difference mainly between New Zealand district nursing and, say, for example, the British model was that in Britain and elsewhere, it was frowned upon if district nurses provided what we might think of as welfare relief. So if a family needed, furniture or bedding or food, New Zealand district nurses would do their best to organise that as well. And there was a district nurse in Whanganui who would make her own soup and pass it around in billy cans to her patients. And she had a very understanding landlady who allowed her to use the stove to cook up her soup over a couple of days. And she had generous butchers who would supply her with the meat and the bones. So very much New Zealand district nurses saw that their role was not only to care for the sick in their own homes and to teach family members how to care for their loved ones, but also to make sure that they had the things they needed to be able to survive and care for themselves.
Of course, we think of them at particular times, the emotional labour of wartime nursing, caring and conflict is one chapter, and virus and tremor, nursing and disasters is another. There'll be someone else perhaps reflecting in time and writing another history about nursing in the time of this pandemic. But what again was particular about the profession at these times of crises?
Well, the 1918 influenza pandemic struck New Zealand very hard, and Jeff Rice is the expert historian in this field. So we know from his work how it just really raced through the country, and it was devastating. And you know today how, and with COVID, we are really geared to trying to have the hospitals not overwhelmed. You'll hear that being talked about. In 1918, they were absolutely overwhelmed. And one of the difficulties was that the nursing profession here, the numbers were depleted because a quarter of the registered nurses were still on wartime service overseas. They hadn't returned yet. And of the nurses remaining in New Zealand and the trainee nurses as well, three quarters of them went down with influenza. They were off sick for a long time. And so there were so few nurses left in the hospitals who could manage. You might have on one ward no ward sister because she was off with influenza. You might have just a trainee nurse trying to organise everything. They had to call in volunteers, citizens who would come and help, and they did. So this lone trainee nurse might be teaching them the basics very quickly, organising and supervising their work, and trying to remain well herself so she could keep working. We know from the nurses who their voices have been captured on oral history recordings, which is just wonderful to have that resource. We can hear them talking about the grim time, as they called it, of the pandemic. And they often they didn't expect to survive because they could see how quickly people could die. And the patients they were looking after in hospital were the sickest, and they were often delirious, trying to climb out the windows, trying to get out of the ward. And you knew if a patient turned a very dark purple, almost black, from cyanosis, that they were about to die. So it was a dreadful time because the best nursing you could provide still wouldn't save these patients. And it was very hard. Hester McLean, who was the chief nurse, said it was a nightmare of a time, and so it was.
Pamela, it's a fascinating book. Thank you very, very much, Pamela Wood, and her book is New Zealand Nurses Caring for Our People, 1880 to 1950.